From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made with a difficult decision. Raven Osborne, a PhD student at the University of Rochester Medical Center, was thinking about her future. She had about 5.5 years left in her program, but her feelings of isolation, being on edge, and her frustration with what we might call code switching made her question how long she could stick with the program. Raven is a student of color, one of a low number of minority students in STEM-related majors and professions. After much consideration, Raven did decide to stay with her program, and now she'll be able to network with other students of color at the university. A group of graduate students have formed a new chapter of the Alliance for Diversity in Science and Engineering. Their mission, to increase participation of underrepresented groups in academia, industry, and government. Alliance meetings give students a chance to meet with underrepped faculty from other universities so they can hear their success stories and to meet with fellow students to deal with those feelings of isolation that Raven described. This hour, we talk to the founders of the Rochester chapter. We'll hear their stories and discuss ideas for how to encourage students of color to pursue STEM professions. We'll also talk about the current job landscape, where according to the National Science Foundation, nearly 70% of scientists and engineers employed full-time are white. I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour. Hello to Anthony Planzinski-Figueroa, faculty advisor for the Alliance for Diversity in Science and Engineering at the University of Rochester and director of operations for the David T. Kern Center at the U of R. Welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Also with us is Antonio Tinoco Valencia, president of the Alliance, PhD candidate in organic chemistry. Antonio, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Shukri Abdul-Rashid, vice president of the Alliance, PhD candidate in O-Chem as well. Shukri, welcome to you.
Hi.
And Marianne Akun-Farmer is the social relations chair for the Alliance and PhD candidate in biomedical engineering. Marianne, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having us.
There's a, you know, there is a story on for everyone at this table. And I think in many ways it's helpful to start right away with what brought you into your various fields. And then we're going to talk about your goals and whether you're seeing any progress. But let's go around the table, and we'll start right here with Marianne. So, Marianne, you got a big smile on your face, candidate in biomedical engineering. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
How did you find your way to this field, and kind of give me a little bit of that backstory?
So for me, I kind of found my way in a very non-linear way. It actually started back in high school where I took a chemistry course, and I really liked it. And in the midst of determining my major for, you know, undergrad, thought that chemistry and, you know, the biomedical world were similar. And so this kind of stemmed from the fact that my family, neither of my parents do anything related to engineering or really anything in the medical field. So I didn't have a good mentor in the sense of figuring out truly what I needed to do or how to get to what I thought was interesting. So in the midst of all of this, I essentially ended up at George Washington University, and I enrolled in biomedical engineering. And there, I struggled a lot just from the fact that I didn't know what engineering was. I didn't really have as strong of a background in some of the, you know, the principles of engineering as some of the other students did. But with time and with mentorship from other professors, I actually started going down the route of doing internships and essentially found myself being more and more immersed in the field. So through the internship, I decided to kind of stay within the biomedical engineering world just because I understood what that field was intended to do. And that's really trying to apply engineering principles to medical issues and things of that nature. So for me, again, it wasn't a very linear, very clear path to biomedical engineering. And it was really from guidance of mentors that kind of got me to where I am now.
How wide is your field?
So for example, I think, you know, if you take my lab currently now, you know, I am the only Black student in my lab. I mean, we're not huge, but I have noticed that when I go to conferences, there is a few of people who look like me. And as a result, we tend to gravitate towards each other because we recognize that we have similar struggles in the field. And so how white is our field? I would say maybe BME is a little bit more diverse than other fields in terms of, you know, their other representations outside of like the white man. But BME is still very white in that sense. But yeah, I always think about it in reference to other fields. And I think that it is more progressive maybe, but it still has a long way to go.
But you know, Marion, some listeners are going to say, boy, you know, we talk a lot about race on this program and in this country. And is it too much? Does it matter here? Does it matter in your field?
It does. It matters a lot because it's really difficult for me as a student of color, as a BME student of color, to look around, and especially when it comes to faculty representation, to see not a single one that looks like me at the U of R, at least in the BME, you know, field. And I think it matters because there are certain struggles that I may go through that I don't have a faculty member that looks like me in that sense, or, you know, that I can kind of go to with some of those very specific types of issues and concerns. Now, that is not to negate the fact that there are other faculty that recognize this lack of diversity and are supportive. So I think that it matters a lot. And again, for me, it's really from the sense of not seeing faculty members mm-hmm. who are similar to me. So,
have you had any moments in your educational career where you felt like your race was held against you, was a problem for you, that discrimination was happening?
I think I would say more so in terms of, you know, there's this new term of microaggressions and things of that nature. And I think that inherently that still exists in a lot of people. So, you know, in my field, I think typically, you know, when I step into a room, I do feel that people are automatically questioning the validity of me being in that room. And whether I got there through, you know, my actual merit, or if I got there through being a Black woman in America and somehow getting a handout. And I think that that's one of the biggest struggles of being in the field, because there's always this, you know, I'm a Black woman, so I have two things that I'm always questioning. Is it because I'm Black, or is it because I'm a woman? And I think that, you know, that's something that in my field, in regards to women, there are a lot of women in our field. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done, but in that sense is taken care of. But in the, you know, the Black woman part, you know, I always do feel some sort of insecurity when I walk into a room and people, I can see it in their faces. They're looking at me like, you know, everything I say is challenged, and not in the same way that my colleagues, you know, opinions are challenged.
Your white colleagues.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. What do you want to do in the field? What's ideal? Where are you going to be in 5-10 years?
You know, in the ideal world, I would like to be a faculty member. I would like to be one of, you know, I would like to be that person that I don't see in my field, in the sense of being someone who is doing research that I'm very excited about, but is also a beacon for other students of color who walk into these spaces and kind of feel alone in that sense. So, you know, I would, in the immediate future, get a postdoc, and then eventually get a, you know, tenure track faculty position, and really mentor students from all backgrounds, because I think it is so important for the science field, and really for all fields, to embrace diversity in all forms, not just in terms of skin tone, but in terms of sexual orientation and in terms of other cultural and ethnic, you know, differences. And so for me, it would be ideal to be in a position where I'm able to mentor students from all different places, and hopefully, you know, kumbaya world, get us all, you know, singing and happy together.
Let me turn to Shukri Abdul-Rashid, who is the Vice President of the Alliance for Diversity in Science and Engineering at the University of Rochester, a PhD candidate in organic chemistry. What put you on the road to OChem? Is it just masochism? I joke because I'm gonna say on the air what I told these students before the program. As a journalism student, I learned how to play euchre, and the OChem students were always studying. That's mostly a joke. At 2 a.m. in college, I was playing euchre. I was no longer studying. OChem was still studying. Let me put it that way. That's probably, you could probably relate to
that. I can definitely say that the rigor of the field is something that has attracted me to it. I found that... you know, despite the adversity that's associated with studying such a rigorous field of science, there comes a lot of, you know, a lot of growth and personal development that's associated with, you know, being able to engage in something that's so challenging. I always found that organic chemistry was something that always sort of allowed me to use my inquisitive nature to my advantage, and it was something that I was always inherently sort of motivated to learn more about. I started off at University at Buffalo, undecided, but, heading in the direction of being a pre-medical student. And I found that after my second year, so when I was in my sophomore year of undergrad, I took organic chemistry and I took a liking to it. I found that I performed pretty well, and I found that it was something that I really was motivated to understand more about. So I often stayed after class and talked to professors, about my questions and ask if I could, do undergraduate research in their laboratories. And overall, it was something that, I knew that I would like to move forward with, in terms of my career path.
Have you run up against what you feel like is any discrimination or any sort of either a social cost or educational cost just based on your own background?
Absolutely. So, in regards to, microaggressions, it's something that, it's a little bit more subtle. So it's a lot harder to address. And I would say, although these things exist, they become problematic, in our own heads. Right. So, just overthinking and over-evaluating situations can often cause a lot of discomfort and just a lot of additional pressure. To perform well, to overperform, right? To prove that you have what it takes to be here, to prove that you're at least equal to your counterparts, right? So, in that regard, it's always a persistent challenge to be able to sort of silence these voices that are in your head that are telling you that you're not good enough, that you don't have what it takes, and it makes the failures that you experience so much more, felt, when you fail, you feel like you've let down your entire race, sometimes. And, you feel like you've only sort of, validated the stereotypes relating to intellectual inferiority and things along those lines. But I would say, being a minority in science, although, there's a lot of, psychological, sort of difficulties that you encounter. In many ways, you have a lot of advantages, in that these programs, they're now looking for diverse applicants, and there's a lot of opportunities for people that are minorities in STEM to sort of advance. And there's multiple platforms and organizations that are designed to increase diversity in STEM. So right now is a good time. And as Marion said, there's a lot of work that continues to be done. Or needs to be done. So that's what ADSE intends to address.
That's pretty heavy. Do you feel like you are constantly having to prove and reprove yourself?
Absolutely, every day. Whether I give a presentation or even whether it's the way that I hold a 20-second conversation in the elevator, constantly under the gun. I feel like that's something that's going to continue to persist, and we can definitely address these issues extrinsically as we try to increase diversity in STEM, but I recognize that I also have some work to do myself in terms of me being more comfortable in my abilities, and know that I'm here because of my credentials and my hard work.
You want to add, Marion? I saw Marion I would say, vigorously agreeing with the idea that you're kind of constantly feeling like you have to prove yourself or prove your intellectual capabilities.
Yeah, that is probably one of the hardest parts about being in the field, and especially pursuing a PhD, and especially wanting to be in a faculty role. We talk a lot about, I don't know if you've heard of the imposter syndrome, and a lot of students feel that imposter syndrome. And I can't speak for my white colleagues in terms of their level of imposter syndrome, but I know that for mine, it's, the imposter syndrome, what feels like times 10, just from the standpoint of kind of what Shukru was just describing, where I've walked out of presentations and just started crying, and my PI is like, you did a phenomenal job, but it feels as if, and a lot of this is also my personal, need to be maybe perfect or need to make my parents proud or needs to not be that black girl who could have been great and couldn't be great because she just can't do it. This is a bit of a hard one for me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Maria. Sorry. Well, listeners, you're seeing, you know, how heavy this can be. And that's Marion Acoon Farmer, who is the Social Relations Chair for the Alliance for Diversity in Science and Engineering at the University of Rochester and a PhD candidate in biomedical engineering. And you just heard Shukri Abdul-Rashid, and Shukri is Vice President of the Alliance and also a PhD candidate in organic chemistry. Marion, I really admire you. I just want you to know, you know, kind of open it up and pouring it out for us, because I think it's important for people to hear it. So I want to go across the table and bring in Antonio Tinoco Valencia, who's the president of the Alliance and a PhD candidate also in organic chemistry. It's tough to hear this, but I know there's you feel a real sense of sort of kinship with what they're feeling there.
Absolutely. So, I mean, just being part of this organization since us three originally got together and decided to start this, it's been empowering. And I feel right now it's just, you can sense the level of camaraderie that we have amongst us.
Tell me a little bit about your story, your path into science.
So my path into science started in high school when I took AP Calc with my math teacher that I had taken for 3 years in high school. And, you know, I was horrible in math. Like, that was the subject that I struggled with the most. But I found it so challenging, and I found it so intriguing. And I loved feeling like I was being probed, like my mind was being probed, and I sensed the growth there. So once I, you know, I took AP Calc, I failed the test. I think I failed the class too, but I was interested in pursuing a STEM career, but because of my undocumented status, I had no idea how to go about going to college, right? I didn't have a social security number. I didn't qualify for financial aid. I just thought it was a complete impossibility. But my math teacher told me, well, you know, you can go to community college, start there, and then hopefully by the time you're ready to transfer out, a bill or a policy will allow you to go to a university and you can go off from there. So that's what I did. I went to East LA College, which is primarily a Hispanic serving institution in the east side of LA. That's where I'm originally from. I was born in Mexico, but my family and I moved to LA. So I started at East LA College. I enrolled in, you know, in introductory chemistry. I failed it. I didn't know how to study for science. I came from a underprivileged high school, so once I started at East LA College, I just did not have to, I had to start from scratch. So in my mind, I wanted to be an engineer, or I wanted to pursue an engineering degree. And I remember meeting with the counselor, he was this Caucasian man. I told him, he asked me, what do you want to study? And I said, I want to study chemical engineering. And he laughed at my face. And I was so heartbroken. But honestly, I just kind of used that as fuel. And I was just like, you know what? No, like I'm going to give it my all. And I'm going to fail trying. Like, I'm not going to let this stop me. So, you know, I took most of my lower level classes there at East LA College. I was president of the chemistry club there. And through that, I met a very good my chemistry professor. She was also the advisor for the chemistry club. And she was the first woman of color, her family's from Ecuador, that I saw that she had a PhD. She came from a very disadvantaged background, and she made it. And it was just like seeing her made me think like, wow, like if she can do it, there's absolutely no reason that I can't. And it was from that point that I was just, ignorantly just in my mind, I was, I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to study science. I changed from engineering to chemical engineering, and then now chemistry. It just happened out, you know, it happened that way that I became more interested in chemistry. Only after the fact I took organic chemistry, which is really funny that you say a lot of people, you know, they relate organic chemistry as this, like, super hard class that everyone, you know, it's a weeder course, mm-hmm. as people say. But I absolutely loved it. It was the first time I saw science in a three-dimensional way that it just made sense and it clicked. And then after ELAC, I went to California State University, Los Angeles, which wasn't that far from ELAC. And then I did undergraduate research there. And I applied to graduate school, and the U of R accepted me. Of course, there was, I'm not even touching on the fact of that my undocumented status made everything 100 times more difficult. I'm here now.
And when you have to go back and think about literally someone laughing, who was it that laughed in your face?
It was a STEM counselor.
It was a STEM counselor? It wasn't just like a school counselor. It's like, oh, you engineering. A STEM counselor.
Yes.
Telling you this is not for you.
Yes.
So when you think about that, and then you think about what your colleagues at the table have talked about and the pressure they feel to sort of always rep, always, and in some ways it's not just about one person feeling like, you know, you may be judged, especially if you're the only person of color, or you're the only that unfortunately you may be judged well beyond just yourself. Do you feel that too?
Absolutely. Yeah. Every day when Shukri was talking about, you know, you have having to carry yourself professionally and having to think about everything that comes out of your mouth. That is a reality for me. It's kind of having this dual like personality. There's science Antonio, and then there's normal Antonio. Like you have to choose your words carefully, and you have to know how to present yourself carefully, because especially for me, you know, no one in my family went to college. I'm one of the few DACA recipients, possibly in the nation, that's doing a PhD in chemistry. You're representing all these people that your family, the people that couldn't make it, that were just as talented as you, but just didn't have the resources or the opportunities open to them. You carry all that weight. I wouldn't say it's a burden, but it definitely weighs you down. And you have to think about your next step, what you're going to say, what you're going to do every single time you talk.
In a moment, we'll talk about what the Alliance for Diversity in Science and Engineering is doing specifically. They've got an event coming up on May 2nd. Miriam's going to tell us about that. We're going to tell us about their social media presence and some of their overarching goals as well here, that if they're successful, what we're going to see start to change. Anthony, some of this stuff is hard. I mean, like, it's hard mm-hmm. to listen to, you know, and I'm the dude at the table is the most privileged, like, it's hard for me as someone who's never experienced that to try to get inside the minds of someone and to see the pain that is like. What's your perspective on this in terms of where things are and where you think we can go with this, Anthony?
Well, first off, I'd like to say I think the listeners are getting the absolute privilege that we get by working with students like this. Our students, our community getting together and then providing opportunities at the university. And it's kind of awkward to say that a little bit because, you know, I'm a graduate of the university. I'm going through graduate programs as well, but also I'm there. We're there protecting, you know, our students and making sure they have the same opportunities, whether it be through advising or whether it be through feeding or anything. Everybody knows graduate students suffer in terms of a number of different ways. What I'm most proud about is that we're moving, this group is adding to a needed void at the university, especially in the academic realm, for being there for first-generation low-income minority students of color, no matter where we have that coverage and opening up the dialogue. And I remember we were talking about the first time we met, Liz Danielli, our assistant director for graduate program, says, hey, the students want to create this group. And we were, and I looked at the paper when she said it. I said, yes. And she goes, well, we need to do this in funding. I go, absolutely. And so, I was like, we need to set up a meeting right away. And we did. And the first thing I said is, I don't even know you all, but yes. And they were like looking at me like I was crazy. It was like,
what's the catch?
Exactly. What is the catch? But I do that on purpose because, so often our students hear no first, or they get told they can't first. And that's the wrong answer. For many different reasons, but above all, we have to open up the doors of educational opportunity for all. And so, for us in the Kern Center and at the university, specifically arts, science, and engineering, as well as the entire university, finding ways for our students to have a community and come together. And the path forward is trying to erase the fact that any one of these students has to come on any show or talk in public and say, I have to represent my entire race inside my lab. I have to represent my entire being in front of a professor or in front of another student. I have to validate who I am in my presence or my intellect. That the next step is making sure that the programs that we're putting in place and that we're advocating for and holding ourselves, the university, other universities in the nation accountable, that this open doors for everyone to have that opportunity.
Well, after our only break, we'll come back and tell you about the events they've got coming up on May 2nd. We'll talk about the work that they're doing to find you on different platforms, and we'll talk about the goals going forward here. If the Alliance for Diversity in Science and Engineering sees the change they want to see, what will campuses look like? What will their field, their various fields, look like? And then there's one other question that I want to make sure we hit, and that's this. Shukri at one point said that in some ways he wants to also think about himself. What is it about himself that makes him feel this way? And while I admire that, I want to ask them what all of us, especially the white men who have got a lot of the power in this country, can do that might change some of that dynamic, that when they're presenting in a room with mostly white people, that they don't feel intensely under a microscope or just riding in an elevator or having conversations or needing to code switch. Whatever the case may be, what they maybe would like to see change as well. Because while I admire Shukri and our guests for kind of talking about looking inward, it's a conversation about all of us. So let's get that only break, and we'll come back with the group from the Alliance for Diversity in Science and Engineering at the University of Rochester next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we welcome Beverly Tatum in the first hour. She's coming to Rochester. She's the author of the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? In our second hour, a conversation about public health, and specifically on this Earth Day, plastics in the Great Lakes. We'll talk with you Monday, a member-supported public radio. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The students from the University of Rochester and faculty advisor are here from the Alliance for Diversity in Science and Engineering and the University of Rochester chapter. And Marian Acoon-Farmer is going to tell us a little bit about what's coming up on May 2nd in particular. Can you do that?
Yes, what's absolutely. All right. So on May 2nd, we have our inaugural Diversity in STEM lecture series. It will be from Dr. Rigoberto Hernandez from Johns Hopkins University. He's a professor of chemistry and the director of the Open Chemistry Collaborative in Diversity Equity, OXIDE organization. We will have two sections of the series. We will have a science lecture, which will be at 10 a.m. in Wegmans Hall 1400. And then we will have a diversity lecture, which will be at 1:30 p.m. in Gergen 108. Now the science lecture is titled Benign by Design from the Nanoscale to the Human Scale. And the diversity lecture is titled Advancing Chemistry Through Diversity. We would like to see everyone there. I think it's going to be a very exciting event. And as I said, it's our first one. So as much support as possible would be really, really appreciated.
All right. So there's some information there. And are we going to find you on social media or
elsewhere?
Absolutely.
We are all over the place. We are on Instagram. You can find us at ADSE_Rochester. You can find us on Facebook at ADSE Rochester. And then you can find us on Twitter at ADSE_Rochester. So again, on Instagram and Twitter, we are ADSE_Rochester, and Facebook is ADSE Rochester. So please follow us.
There you go. I want to ask the members, you know, about some of the changes that you want to see. Like, I mean, if you got a short list of goals, Antonio, what's at the top of them?
At the very top of our goals would be increasing the visibility of minority graduate students. So what does that mean? Increasing the type of support that we have in joining professional events, professional development events, allowing us to, you know, speak on the behalf of why diversity is important in STEM. The second, you know, the on the top of the list would also, for the faculty side, would be to increase the hiring of underrepresented minority faculty members. And this serves as a mechanism to also, you know, support the graduate students that want to be in those positions, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like a twofold mechanism that helps the students and helps the faculty and helps the university in general.
Let me bring a little bit of data into this. Producer Megan Mack finds this via The Atlantic, among other sources. Less than 6% of full-time faculty members at institutions across the country are Black. From the years 2002 through 2017, of the roughly 50,000 people who earned PhDs each year, the percentage who were Black increased from 5.1% to 5.4%. So still a very small number. That's according to the National Science Foundation. In 2017, there were more than a dozen fields, largely subfields within science, technology, and math, in which not a single doctoral degree was awarded to a Black person anywhere in the United States. And the reasons why include a broken pipeline, less access to resources. Frankly, even the Black faculty or faculty of color that are there don't have very encouraging stories to share at times. So let alone, you don't have a whole lot of faculty who look like you if you're a student of color, and the faculty who are there don't always have great experiences. So these are all layered into this. So I want to ask Shakri a question about, you know, sort of a chicken and egg question. There's pretty good research that tells you that for students of color, you are more likely to end up in fields where you see someone, either mentor, role model, et cetera, who looks like you. So high school public teachers, middle school public teachers, elementary school teachers, but across the board. So when it comes to faculty, or when it comes to just, you know, biomed, when it comes to organic chemistry, do you need more faculty first and you end up with more students? Do you need to get more students through the program who will choose? Some will choose to be in faculty, some will work elsewhere. You know, what do you think the pipeline looks like that's going to work?
I think you have to address this from both directions. Mm-hmm. Anyone can definitely see the importance that's associated with being able to have people that are in higher positions that you can look up to. One of the examples that I think of is, I would say about a year ago, we had our first Black faculty candidate come visit the University of Rochester, and he was, he was there for faculty recruitment for a position in the chemistry department, and he gave a very excellent talk, and, I had a chance to sit down and have lunch with him, and after he left, I felt a way and that I hadn't felt in quite some time, and that I was isolated. I was so used to, you know, being, underrepresented that it just kind of became the norm. It didn't even occur to me that there could be another black professor. There could be another black kid in the chemistry department. Those things were just completely beyond my realm of consciousness. So I think, you know, there's definitely, a great amount of importance, you know, and it's salient that we have these individuals who are in higher positions, but it's also a responsibility for, you know, graduate students who are sort of lower on the hierarchy to also, you know, engage in different outreach events. So, you know, the moment all of us chose to come to graduate school as minority scientists, this goal, this trajectory, this became much larger than us. You know, this became, you know, more about our career paths and our aspirations. It became about how are we going to influence the younger generations? How are we going to blaze the trail for those that want to pursue the same sort of passions and degrees that we're pursuing? So it definitely has to be addressed on both ends. I'd like to think that, you know, us being here in graduate school, we have a little bit of pull in both directions. You know, we can definitely speak to some of the administrators as well as the chairs of the department and influence their decisions in regards to faculty recruitment. But we also have a little bit of pull in regards to reaching out to the younger students in undergrad and high school and show them that, you know, this is something that they're capable of accomplishing.
And I want to add to that. There was this very good, I follow AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, on Instagram, and something that she posted on her feed was, you can't become what you don't see. If I don't see a Latino or African-American faculty member, I'm going to think it's an impossibility for me to become a full professor of chemistry at a university. And, you know, I have to say that there is a lot of support for increasing graduate students that are of underrepresented minority status. But interestingly enough, I also read an opinion on the Washington Post where an Ivy League professor says why colleges don't hire more faculty of color. And she blatantly says, we don't want them. Like, why? We're not even given a seat at the table at certain times. So what are the universities doing to mend this issue when you're not even opening up the opportunity to allow underrepresented minority mm-hmm. Candidates to even come to your campus?
You want to add to that, Anthony?
Yeah, because it starts to really talk about the growth of the center and why we've been pushing out there. We, you know, when the students came to us with the goal of starting this organization, we looked at it as yet another ally to help us burst this foundational issue. And so this chicken and egg issue you talk about, we've been developing. And so our center started as three people and now has grown to about 20. And the role of our dean for diversity at the center is now pushed into that. It was an unnatural growth in that it wasn't something that was built in. It's kind of like, you know, we push and created for and advocated for this role. And so over the course of the last 5 years, maybe longer, she's working with faculty to diversify each of the faculty searches. And so what we found is that the infrastructure of faculty hiring is so ornate. It's so institutionalized where it blocks folks out that there needs to be this huge diversity trend in terms of coaching, training, walking individuals through processes on how to avoid microaggressions, how to avoid their biases. And it's an extraordinary lift for institutions to go through because you are not only knocking against privilege and biases and microaggressions and all, you have to then get the institution to buy in and push through it. And so the students on their end, an average PhD is going through the process between 4 and 7 years, depending. We won't ask where our individuals at this table are in because you don't ask that question. It's a full box. but in the course of their lifetime, they may not see that change. And so it's a huge fight and lift that we're looking for allies to do at in the center so that we push through it. And so that's why joining forces, we're working together. And so, but the institution needs to be pushed, and we know that. And I think that that's where we have to keep chugging, because there are examples of good mentorship and leadership out there in the country where we can see this happen.
Let me grab a phone call. Jim in Rochester. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you, Evan. And I want to congratulate the young people for at least trying to get something off the ground. But you have you need to consider the historical perspective, precedent, rather, that has already been set. You had a scientist that came here 1941 at the beginning of World War One. He was before Dr. Bill Knox, his name will come to me, Jim LaValle. LaValle ran in the 1932 or 36 Olympiad in Berlin, Germany. He looked Adolf Hitler eyeball to eyeball, and he beat his team in that 4x100 relay. And he came here as a PhD scientist in 1941 when we had apartheid right here in the United States of America. And after that, Dr. William Knox came, because he was part of the Manhattan Project. If you don't know what that is, those were the people who developed and did the initial research to develop the atomic bomb to end World War II. And then in 1956, I think, Dr. Walter Cooper came, and they all worked in the research lab. But LaValle left because he couldn't take the social dynamic of this community. And he went back to California and taught chemistry at the UC Berkeley, University of California system, and he retired. But he was the first black that they hired as a professional scientist in the research lab at Eastman Kodak. And in the late 50s and 60s, before Dr. Knox retired, it was Dr. Knox, Dr. Walter Cooper, and Dr. Bill Lee. They were all some of the leaders in that research lab at the Eastman Kodak Company when they were in their heyday. And Dr. Knox's specific area of expertise was surface, basically, the study of chemical properties on the surface or something. That's what it is in layman's term. But you have excellent role models to consider. And also, in 92, 93, somewhere back there, the state of New York, the Board of Regents, set aside about $10 million to have STEM programs in school districts throughout the state of New York. So if you could harness and gather this information and plot you out a strategy and a bill of action, a game plan to get more people involved in that, I think you would be on your way to doing something great to this community and for this country.
Jim, as always, thank you for the historical background, the information. We appreciate that. It's always good to hear from Jim. And you know, some of what Jim talks about, that social dynamic when different figures throughout history came into Rochester and had to decide, you know, am I comfortable here? Frankly, am I comfortable working in this community? Am I comfortable being in this community? Anthony just talked about the need to kind of get people to look inward and to challenge some of the biases that will impact students and will impact other faculty. So let's hit that point. Let's stay with that theme. And I'll go around the table. And I'll start with Marion. You know, what can happen among your fellow students, other faculty, that would maybe take some of that weight off of? That when you give a presentation, you're giving it for Marion. You're not giving it for all African Americans in this country, in this world, in this institution. And that you don't always feel that weight of either having to be performative or, you know, sort of on point and kind of guard up. What could happen to start changing that feeling?
I think outright support in you know, my diversity initiatives is important. It is a little awkward for me, honestly, because I have been involved in a lot of diversity initiatives at the University of Rochester, to even discuss that with my lab mates, because it seems as if I am essentially trying to single myself out. And, you know, it just, I think just the support and acknowledgement that diversity is important to me, and them also seeing diversity is an important thing. I think that that would help me, you know, feel supported just with that community in itself, such that when I do go into a presentation, I know that they acknowledge that I'm not doing it for, I'm not trying to represent all Black people. You know, mm-hmm. I think for having, I've actually kind of to some extent had conversations with some of my lab mates in regards to when we had our first, our inaugural meet and greet. And I said to everyone in my lab, I want you to come because it's not just for, you know, a Black woman or a Hispanic male or a Hispanic female. It's not about that. It's seeing your face there tells me that you are an someone who supports what I stand for. Yeah, thank you. Advocate, excuse me, for these initiatives. Because when I don't see your face in the room, when I am so passionate and so, you know, this is something that is so important to me, but yet I support you in some of the other things that you're doing, I do, that lack of support is, I think, what does unfortunately bring some of these feelings that I have on, because I do feel like I'm doing it by myself at that point. But if I can see some of my, you know, lab mates and others around me being in these spaces with me and advocating with me, I mean, that's huge for me.
Okay. Shukri?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with everything that Marion has to say. I think that, you know, sometimes when people see diversity or minority, it's sort of, you know, kind of comes off as though other people aren't welcome, you know. But I would say that ADSC, you know, we welcome all people, you know, of different sexual orientations, of different races, genders, anybody, you know, is welcome to participate in our cause, because everyone is a part of it. You know, I think that, you know, these issues, you know, I don't think that they can be explicitly sort of solved. I don't think before I give a presentation, you know, one of my white colleagues comes up to me and taps me on the shoulder and is like, you know, even though you're, you know, a black man in STEM, I think you're going to do all right this presentation. I don't think that those sort of things are going to make a difference. But what I can say is I can encourage everyone. You know, minorities, Caucasians, you know, no matter the person, I can encourage these people to be introspective and sort of, you know, think about, you know, some of the feelings. And you have to dig deep and you have to have a lot of emotional intelligence to be able to address these things, because they're so buried, and they're buried so much that, you know, they're almost, you know, they're almost not even a part of our consciousness. You know, but I think that, you know, if you find yourself being a little bit more argumentative when, you know, a Black woman presents her science as opposed to a white man, you might have to ask yourself, why is that? Why do I not, you know, necessarily believe that this person, you know, what they've presented is something that is, you know, believable or, you know, factual? You know, I think really this is something, and although this is an issue, you know, that unfortunately minorities are on the bad end of, you know, I think that this is an issue that, you know, is going to require for all of us to look within ourselves, you know, and sort of, you know, counter these stereotypes, these biases. So I really think it comes from within.
Antonio, we're down to about our last 2 minutes. Go ahead.
So one thing I want to remind the listeners and people here is that science can only be done well, if, especially in the collaborative research setting, research group setting, if you have people of diverse backgrounds coming together, diverse backgrounds having diverse ideas, coming together and working together to solve the problems that are of most importance in our nation and in the world. You can't have everyone be from the same background and have the same type of training and have the same socioeconomic status and have the same religion, race, whatever it be, because you're going to have an implicit bias towards your research. You're not going to be able to see other people's point of views and their take on their research. So we have to remind ourselves that research that is done well is usually done by a diverse group. And I can give you an example of my research group. We have people from all over the country, all over the world. We have people from Germany, China, India, Italy, and we're one of the most productive groups in our department. So just, you know, diversity here, it's as inclusive as possible. And I think our organization, ADSC, we strive for that highest level of inclusivity.
Marion, 20 seconds. The ADSC's got information out there. Where can people learn more about what you're doing?
On our social media sites, as I mentioned before. So as I mentioned, we have an Instagram and Twitter, which is ADSE_Rochester. And then we have a Facebook that is ADSE Rochester. So all of our events will be there. We also have a website through the university as well, and as well as a Gmail account, which Antonio will give you the handle for.
Yeah, ADSERochester@gmail.com.
And then their events, especially May 2nd coming up, learn more on their social media sites. I want to thank the students from the Alliance for Diversity in Science and Engineering at the University of Rochester. Marion Akun Farmer, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Shukri Abdul Rashid, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Our thanks to Antonio Tinoco Valencia. Antonio, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Anthony Planzinski Figueroa, who's the faculty advisor. Nice having you as always. Thank you. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Christine Adamo, volunteer. Thank you, Christine. Megan Mack is the outstanding producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Wherever you are this weekend, hope it's a beautiful one for you, and we'll talk to you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.